Good morning, everybody. Welcome to fourth paper of the morning in Track 7, Multi-Gigabit Serial Interconnect. My name is Amrish Varma from Cadence Advanced Systems. The title of the paper is Simulation Techniques for 6 Gigabit Serial Interconnect Serial Links. And the author is Don Tillian, Brian Kirk, and Sergio Camarillo. Sergio is from Ericsson, Brian Kirk is from Amphenol. CCS and Don was a consultant at SI Guys. This paper has been nominated for the Best Paper Award, here's a plaque for the authors and some copies. So, thank you.
Thank you, Ambrish. Always a delight to be at DesignCon to present. Very interesting work this year. We're excited about this work. I want to highlight the little plus sign. Ambrose said 6 gigabit links, but we made a point to always show the frequency plots going kind of beyond 6 gigabit. It's also an honor to present with both Sergio and Brian. I think between us, we're getting close to maybe 100 years of SI experience, so keep rooting for us. We'll keep working at it. So the way we'll go through the talk today, first, Sergio is going to be sharing about the process, and I consider Sergio quite a visionary in terms of SI as we've worked together over a couple decades now. From there, Brian from Amphenol TCS will come up and discuss some things about modeling and really the we're not going to cover everything there, but the things this year that we've found to be very, very relevant. From after that, I will be back to discuss link simulation. And I'll be illustrating really techniques by working through the process with some living examples. So with that, Sergio.
Thank you, Donald. It's a pleasure to be here at DesignCon. Thank you all for being here with us. Simulation process, 6 gig plus, what's new about that? Well, channel simulators have been around for quite a while. On the open market, we have seen impulse response simulators being available for way more than 5 years. Those were available before as proprietary solutions. Those of us that have worked with service providers and ASIC providers, OEMs were given simulators to work with way before those were available in the open market. Perhaps there were more restrictions, perhaps a little bit less flexibility. The open market has definitely brought some improvements and new possibilities with respect to that. Standards, SAS, started to emerge, and they use simulators. They really make them part of the way the standards expect, and so on and so forth.
Can you stand closer to the microphone?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me better now? Yes. I'll try, and please tell me again if I don't. So, what has happened? Well, frequencies have gone up significantly, and the number of bits that we want to simulate has also increased a lot. Now we want to see thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of bits being simulated. We want to get a more and more refined rendition of our channel. We used techniques years ago for signal integrity at a much lower speed where a lot of emphasis was put memory interfaces, for instance, some that I can think of. We looked a lot at populations, exploration, what-if analysis, trade-offs, different ways to look at variables in those situations. But We couldn't quite do all of that with respect to serial links at high speed, mostly because it would take too long. And there is a sense of practicality for a practicing engineer, meaning that we need to deliver results in a fairly short time. And if simulation takes minutes or hours, we are okay. If we end up with a final check where we really want to stress the system, and perhaps it takes a couple of days over the weekend, that may still be okay, but in previous situations where to get a good visibility on the system, it would take us weeks or several weeks, there was really not much sense at pursuing that, at least every time. Once and for all at the end, maybe, but only maybe. So we are seeing that becoming available. And we are also seeing another aspect, meaning equalization settings, hundreds of them, thousands of them, can be checked early on in the design phase before we fab out the components of that system. Typically a few boards, a couple of boards in the back plane, a couple of boards in the mid plane, but we are talking about multi-board systems, at least in the examples that we are going to bring. Now, to do all of this, what do we need? We need models that are accurate. Models of what? Models of the silicon and its behavior, models of the interconnects, the parasitics. No, they are not parasitics, they are elements. They are elements in our link. The traces, the vias, the connectors, and the metal and the dielectrics that are in there. Accurate. We could probably discuss about the meaning of accurate for years, maybe, and pretty much all of us in the room would perhaps have a slightly different definition. To me, accurate is that something that I use to look at a system before it's getting built, it will find a match with the reality that I will measure. I'm not talking about an absolute accuracy that covers all of the conditions. No, I'm happy enough, so to speak, if what I measure for the vendors that I have selected, where I'm going to build that hardware and so on and so forth, it was indeed predicted by the simulation effort that was put in place. To me, that is a great achievement, and it doesn't happen every time. We can do better than that, I agree, but in practical terms, that is already a very good thing to get, and we don't get there all the time. Why do I talk about partnership? Well, first of all, what we are presenting today, it is indeed resulting from the work of the three of us here, as well as the work of another person, just to name one among others, Kusuma Kumari Mata, that is here in the audience, that has solved tens or perhaps hundreds of via structures with different anti-pads, with different parameters, and so on and so forth. Why partnership? Well, what I said before, we need predictability for what we are going to build in a certain place, with a certain vendors, with certain fabs. Perhaps we need to talk to those fabricators. Perhaps we need to talk to the people where We are getting parts, connectors, boards, components from. There needs to be a dialogue, there needs to be an interaction, there needs to be the mutual will or willingness to uncover problems and find the solutions and working together. Simulation process. I need to speed up because we have a lot to cover. One thing that I want to put emphasis on is that arrow up there that says time. I'm not going to cover something that is done in one day. No, it actually takes perhaps a few months. And it goes from feasibility, sensitivity analysis to uncover variables, and then an exhaustive analysis to stress the worst case or the corners that we found. At the very beginning of this process, the design space, the realm of possibilities that we may be looking at, is typically very large. This is also a process that is taking us to an idea, very generic or very open, to a final solution that is a solution. So it is intrinsically way more practical and way more concrete. So if we look at this, we can think that up there on the upper half, we have architectural challenges, or physical architectural challenges, perhaps. The data rate, the system configuration, the channel length, is it going to be a mid-plane or a back-plane? Is it going to be big, small? And you can go on and on. And there are variables to control, and then there is a channel to define. In the lower portion of it, we can look at engineering variables, engineering entities, things that we can control to some extent, and our connector selection, service selection, what type of stack up, the materials that we use, the via construction, and the rest that you see there. Again, all of this, it converges to a channel design. How do we go about it? Well, from this feasibility and simulations, clearly we start to move to a sensitivity analysis where we stress, we play with some variables to understand what really makes a difference in the behavior of the channel. Do the length really make a difference? Or is it the stub of a via? Or is it this? Or is it that? What do we need? Do we need to enlarge the anti-pad? Do we need to check this? Sensitivity is a very, very powerful thing to provide answers, but also to rule out those things that are not making any difference. And for the time being, we can set aside and focus and concentrate on the big hitters. When the channel design, the guidance that we got from the sensitivity has led us towards a channel design and better defined, we can then put in the manufacturing tolerances and the settings and perhaps increase our margin and expand a little bit our likelihood of success. Now, looking at this, it is implicit one element of improvement over time, that is model accuracy. We start at the beginning with models that may not be that accurate, but they execute very, very fast. We can see very many turns, very many trade-offs, and focus on the behavior of the channel. But over time, the models of the vias, the models of the connectors, the models of all of the elements ought to be refined and improved to get to the point when we are ready to have out these elements. We have high confidence that what we see is indeed what we will get. What is a channel? Well, typically, interconnector described by S parameters. And for something that is already built and it's in the lab, one S parameter can actually tell me everything. But for what we are doing, for what we are talking about, we are better off if we have cascaded S-parameter elements, and we need to make sure that they work correctly and we do not accumulate too large of an error, of course. S-parameters cascaded are better because they allow us to focus on the single element, the single blocks, and change them and sweep them and see which one has the most effect. So, on a channel, and we are talking about one channel, we are not talking about crosstalk, that is another full-blown presentation, not today. we are looking at a three-card system where we have a TX card, a backplane, and an RX card. And we immediately identify on the TX a big chunk of interconnect, a trace, and then there is the backplane. And the RX, we split that trace into two portions because there is a capacitor in between, an AC coupling capacitor. Now, going one step further, we have the TX package. You can see the writing that is kind of aligned with the figure that is referred to. And then we have a backplane connector, another backplane connector, and the RX package on the other side. the vias. Obviously, from the package, from the TX package, we need to go down inside the TX card, so we need a via. We travel, we get to the connector, and we surface with another via. And we can move on. This process really takes us along the entire path. So we have vias for the backplane connectors and vias for the RX capacitor and so on and so forth. Now, I will get back to this in just a moment. Vias are 3D structures and are typically field solved with a 3D solver, and we get S parameters out of that. The TX model for the silicon, a model for the capacitor, and the RX model, the other part of the series. Right. Now, there are some indications here in the slide that says vendor-supplied S parameters, meaning the origin of these models. Transmission line models. Transmission line models, I get back here again to the partnership because the tools are giving transmission line models to us. Most of them are good or acceptable. Pretty much all of them, they get much, much better if we talk to the fabs. If we improve that model, if we refine it, if we take care of adding in the effect of processing and the press and the temperature and this and that, we don't want to know all of the details, just the effect, and add them in. Partnership is again very important for this. Then, the service. It could be a model that we get from the vendor, and we do, but we need something that executes very, very fast. And we identified, and Donald is going to talk about this later on, the analog behavior of the service and all of what we overlay on top of it that is more in the equalization and perhaps a mathematical description of that. Now, we talked about 17 cascaded elements, and I am about to conclude this. With fast models, we can understand a lot about the behavior of the interconnect. Even if the models are not with the absolute precision, we want to understand the trade-offs of the interconnect. And one element that I want to stress is that we actually need let me say, a library of vias where for each condition, for each via, we look at which layer we are escaping to. And depending upon the frequency, we say 6+, we may need to look at several different levels in the PCB stack-up and have different S parameters for more than one escape condition. And with this, let me continue on and introduce Brian Kirk with modeling techniques.
Thank you, Sergio. So I think as Mike's paper before pointed out, and it complements this paper quite well, actually, the via impedances and the positioning and the transition of them along this whole like 17-element interconnect is actually quite critical. So we're going to just kind of cover via models, and because they are the primary discontinuity, and their spacement is somewhat fixed. So as in the previous paper, they said at certain spacing on the backplane, vias actually create bigger standing waves and more ISI effect. The vias actually cause the largest amount of discontinuity. A lot of times their position is fixed. And the reflections from each of them is actually what causes large degradation in the overall link performance. And it's actually, if you take 17 elements in a link, and we're off by 0.3 or 0.4 dB on each one of those elements, we can actually wipe out, 6-7 dBs of the signal quite easily. So it's this, the way we build channel models and cascading means that each individual element and how it cascades together is kind of quite critical to the overall performance. As this says here, subtle changes actually can make 50 to 100% improvement, actually. And that's, on the cascaded level, but also on the insertion loss, if we're looking at the difference between 0.2 dB and 0.3 dB. And then if we do not so subtle things like backfilling, you get clear, as Mike pointed out, massive improvements in performance. So this is actually a good example down here that actually kind of shows different types of via structures that we'll actually commonly see. And this shows actually very inductive vias. And it's not uncommon to actually see very inductive vias on line cards for us. Like if we look around AC coupling caps and elements like that, sometimes the layout in that area isn't as impedance controlled, or the layout of the AC coupling cap and the ground vias associated with it will actually cause significant inductance around the packages and the capacitors. This actually is, as Donald will show later, actually of large concern because it's close to the receiver elements. For differential vias, we tend to actually be able to actually control the impedance since there's kind of a built-in return path on all of them. And almost on all of our backplane vias, what we'll talk about here, all the via impedances are actually low. So I think during the question period on the last paper, someone said, what's the nominal impedance you would see on the vias? And that's really driven by the thickness of the board and the aspect ratio of the board. So in the case of the system that the three of us worked on together, they were quite thick backplanes, and therefore the aspect ratio required a large drill bit. So that's what drives a lot of the via impedances. So this is kind of a model, actually, and this is actually the same footprint model that Mike actually had in his paper a minute ago. And even though in this analysis we used a different connector system, but I grabbed this model because it's easy to point out quite a few errors or mistakes that we see in the model. The first thing that actually is probably the most important to any via model is actually the excitation port. And this is the thing from a connector vendor actually that concerns me the most, because a lot of times I'll send out an S parameter model and someone says, I modeled your whole connector in a link, and they have no idea how I actually cut the bottom of the connector off. So how I attach the connector, or how I terminate the connector, actually dictates how you actually make the via model. So in this case, what you can see here is this shaded thing is a wave-guided structure placed at the vias, and this is actually a little bit difficult to see. But in the case of this connector, there's actually only a ground here. So we only connect the ground pin where there's actually a ground pin in the system. And then that actually dictates a lot of the crosstalk and the performance of that via system. If I actually take this waveguide structure and I move it right down to the top level of the PCB, there's about a 20 mil difference in there right now. Then what I'll get is actually too much capacitance around the pads. So the pads are the largest structure on the board, but they're usually, just a couple mils thick. So if you extrude those pads and make waveguide structures around them, which you'll then be exciting the model with a significantly wrong impedance. The other thing that's it's kind of subtle, actually, and we still see a lot of people have issues with it. If you do a VIA extraction from a, like, say, an Allegro files use the finished hole size, typically, in the file. When we're doing the signal integrity analysis, we only care about the drilled hole size because that's the outer diameter of the barrel. That's what really drives the impedance of the vias. So when you're making vias, what you want to make sure is you're actually always modeling the drill size, and especially during an extraction. So anytime we do an extraction off of a customer's Allegro board or something like that, we build a secondary database that actually changes everything from finished to drill size. So the other kind of interesting thing about this is actually just boundary conditions. So this, I purposely grabbed this model, as I said, and you can see that these are the two signal vias. This is actually the ground via here. And the signal vias and the ground vias are quite far spaced out. And then actually I purposely put the boundary conditions close. And in this case, it's a radiation boundary so that we don't get a cavity resonant inside that structure. The interesting thing about this, though, is, you know, frankly, we always try to make these 3D models smaller and smaller just so we can get faster and faster computation time. But what ends up happening on a lot of these structures is actually now the signals couple as much to the boundary condition as they do to the model. So if you take this, now we have about a 0.2 dB error, or 20% error, on one model. So when we actually cascade 17 of these, all of a sudden our correlation is quite bad. So this is actually just showing the impedance of the vias, as we said, is actually quite the issue. So this kind of shows our traditional red model here. And then as we remove metal, make antipads bigger, as Mike pointed out, you can see the green improvements. And then as we refine models, etch placement, and actually port impedances, then we can actually continually increase the via impedance. With smaller drills and stuff, you can get better impedances, but again, that's dictated to the overall system. So in this case, just a 10 ohm improvement could show significant difference at the link level, which Donald will demonstrate. So this part here shows two elements that I think are important for vias. One is the gross level stub that's always a problem, and that's kind of the first level of attack that everybody does. But each of the actual via impedances actually has a skirt that actually rolls off and produces this amount of loss here. So in here, where we're in dBs, you can see this is the 0.2 to 0.3 dB that you can easily see accumulate across your link based on back drilling and where the stub exists. So different stubs produce different amounts of loss, and they also cause different amounts of impedances. So, and typically, any of our top layer vias always have longer stubs, and those are the ones we want to start with to look at first. And then this is actually kind of the first level of attack, is actually just calculation of the stub frequency. But what it doesn't actually do is tell us how the impedance match up down the link. So without the full 3D analysis and seeing the impedances, the more simple equations like this actually can give you quite false results. So this is actually showing the actual backplane case here. And you can see at a quarter of an inch backplane, we expect a kind of complete resonance or collapse of the via around 4 gigahertz, as you've seen here. So clearly we need to backfill this scenario. You can see the significant improvement in impedance, and then this leftover amount of impedance is due to the density of the connector system based on the aspect ratio of the board and the drills used. So that's typically the limitation we get. So if we can make the backplane thinner, down around 200 mils, we can generally change out the drills and actually fix that, but that doesn't work in these large-scale systems all the time. So this actually shows just the difference in back drilling. And you can imagine if we have four of these in the system, you can see that we actually have 1.8 dB of difference. So a 7x improvement in insertion loss based on the via structure. And then just the back drilling improves these periodic reflections down the link by over 30 ohms. So a couple other things just quickly. Trace construction at the higher data rates is still probably the most important thing we work on. Skin effect, how it's actually calculated, where the losses come from. It's difficult to model all those aspects. And then in all of our things, this AC cap placement, vias, and mounting are the closest spaced things on the board. And those actually generally cause us the most amount of problems in newer systems due to the fact of the close placement, and sometimes they're kind of forgotten about. And then finally, SERDES packages and parasitics are essentially to get accurate models of these because of all these closely spaced elements. So I'm going to turn it over to Donald, who actually kind of is the workhorse here and processed all the linked data.
Okay, thank you, Brian. I have a difficult challenge of presenting a lot of the meat of the paper, and we're kind of out of time. So if you need to get to the keynote, We won't be offended at all if you get up and leave. However, I will continue to go on presenting for those who are able to stay. I'm sure we won't lose the room because of the lunch break. So we've found as we move along that we definitely have to learn from measurements. Of course, these take different forms. They've been discussed in other papers here. One of the interesting things is that while the 2D structures, I would say right now, correlate very well with measurement, we've been learning a lot of interesting things about the more 3D structures. And in the case of vias, they can be off by a couple ohms. And you wind up wondering, you know, what's right, the measurement or the model, because of some of the complexities around that. So it's an important area to pursue. We continue to do that. I probably drive both these guys crazy because I define different stages in the process and try to improve the models at every one of those stages. Now, we did talk about going above six gigabits per second. It's important to realize that some of the assumptions we made at lower frequencies may not hold true at higher frequencies, so we're encouraging investigation and checking your assumptions as you move along. And the example shown here is the PN skew looking fine at 3 gigahertz, but over 5 gigahertz starts to separate with a routing pattern like this that we probably thought would have been acceptable. Once we have good models of everything in the channel, we can sum their loss individually. And I go in and look at the individual model level. These are some typical numbers you would get from the different parts of the cascaded channel. Of course, if you have good models, then you're going to get the correct loss at the system level. And I should point out, as I go quickly through this here, this is backed up by a 24-page paper, so some things that seem fuzzy, please refer to the paper for more detail. But this shows that the loss we achieve by summing the individual elements is the same loss we measure here. So, of course, the correct loss means that you'll have the right amplitude. The right amplitude gives you the correct I. Now, one thing that's important to point out is that the single-ended loss, shown here in green, can be and is even expected to be quite different than the differential loss. So I'm guilty of working in the single-ended world too much, but I'm learning to spend my time in the differential world, which is, you know, significantly different at the frequencies of interest here. So, of course, there's also industry mass, that insertion loss deviation, things like that. Those are interesting measures. Some standards require them. For me personally, they don't always map exactly to what does that really mean to the performance in my system. So we're going to move beyond these kinds of things and get into eye diagrams that I have a little better understanding of. Before I do that, very quickly though, we are assuming that our SERDES modeling takes a rapid approach. There's typically two parts in your model. There's an analog portion and an equalization portion. The analog, we've gotten pretty good at mimicking anything we find in a data sheet in that part of the model. That's not real hard to do. But then the equalization is often quite complex and winds up in an executable. And the industry is standardizing on this AMI idea right here. And so that's the approach we're using here. So now we get into the actual link simulation. And I want to start that by defining a few metrics. Now, of course, I have the channel. I've gone beyond the passive channel, and I've put the active devices on the end. Of course, the standard metric is eye height and width, right? And so that's what we're going to be working with most here. But to really understand a good eye, we're recommending that you be in the million-bit area. And in previous papers, I've defined ways to figure out how many bits that you need. However, one way to do that is to make sure that you're kind of getting beyond the knee in your bathtub plot. So that's the area that I like to live in, aside from the ISP concept that's been defined previously. Of course, these eyes also change dramatically with data patterns, and that's been expressed in other papers here as well. Statistical jitter sources end up being applied to take you down the bathtub there. We're going to pull the numbers out, like the last paper, at 1e to the 12. So in this eye right here, the baseline metric that I pull out, I've got 156/0.41. So what's going to happen now is I'm going to pull you out of the world of eye diagrams, and every number is going to be abstracted into a chart. But of course, you have to achieve first a reasonable eye. We explained that in last year's paper, and then test that eye at the different corners, and then extract your parameters into a chart. We got used to doing this in the SI world with all kinds of metrics in the past, but in the rest of the presentation, you won't see any more eye diagrams. The example shown here is a normalized eye height versus data pattern, and shows in this case, as we move through the compliance jitter pattern all the way down to PRBS-32, we're down at 75% in our eye height. Width is not changing much. Okay, so here we go. If you were going to spend time probably on any one page in the paper, I would recommend this page right here. This is an extremely interesting chart. I showed you the baseline numbers for our channel, and those numbers are expressed right here. Now, this is a chart that shows you eye height on this in red dots and eye width over here in the blue dots. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to take that channel, and one by one, we're going to slide every one of the variables through its manufacturing tolerance. Okay, so the different variables we're sliding are expressed in this table from the paper and kind of explained in shorthand down here. So one of the really interesting things about this paper, of course, is the parameters that take you way outside of the baseline. Okay, so and for example, this parameter here, all I did was change one single variable and I wound up way up here, you know, high in the goodness side of the chart. Okay, this is the badness side down here, and that's the goodness side up there. but I think it's also interesting to look at which of these parameters don't change things much. Okay, there's things in here like the impedance and on the transmit and backplane that aren't hitting you as much as you might expect. So the paper discusses that. But obviously, looking at this chart, I will benefit by managing some of my parameters on my transmit card and on my backplane. But if I only had so much time to spend on the project, the biggest hitter and the place where I would want to spend the most of my time is managing my discontinuities on my receiver card. And we'll talk more about that. Okay. So some of the things that took us outside of that center band, one is the transmit amplitude. And thankfully, at least the way we're simulating it right now, we found that if our eye is collapsing at the receiver, we can, it's a pretty much linear response to just increase that amplitude at the transmitter and get a better eye at the receiver. That wasn't intuitive to me. I didn't expect to see that, but that's a nice attribute. Now, in the previous plot, one of the things I showed is the connector pins gave me more variation than I expected. And even though the loss, this plot shows here, the loss in each connector pin is about the same, but when you pair that with the vias that have to be there for manufacturing reasons, you can get quite a bit of loss variation, up to 1 dB between connector pins that really were similar. Okay, but between the long short pins on the connector, you put them with the vias, and you wind up with the variation there. So those are important things to simulate as well. Also, the backplane length, of course, as I get a longer backplane, I want to use a little more equalization. And this is showing that as I increase my backplane length, this is plotting the percentage of a post-tap or how much equalization I want to apply in the post-cursor bit. And no surprise there, that's fairly linear with backplane length as well. So these are some of the things that we've learned, but let's explore this notion of equalization across a wide range of channels. So, sorry for this really busy plot. Let me try to make it simple for you. I've defined 22 different types of channels with now starting to widen the space that I'm looking at and giving all kinds of different lengths on the different cards. And no surprise here, if I plot it according to channel length, I get increasing amounts of optimal EQ that I should apply. Okay. Now, most tools will calculate that value for you. But the interesting thing about this plot is that the eye height, sorry for the yellow, but if you can see that yellow, the eye height is all over the map, okay? It's not going with channel length. It's not even going with equalization setting. So what on earth is going on here? So since I've defined an important metric in the eye height, I can plot this according to eye height. So what I'm looking at here is descending eye height. And you see my channel lengths now are the things bouncing around. All right? Lo and behold, a very interesting phenomenon here. All right? The min lengths on the cards, that's what's expressed in the green here, those seem to correspond to the worst eye heights. All right? So, this is a really important statement, and it's probably behind someone's head for you, so sorry about that. But now we're kind of bouncing into the last paper here. Okay, I could try to equalize this thing all day long, but I'm not going to fix this problem. I mean, remember, this simulation has the ideal equalization applied to it. Okay, but my eye is falling apart, and it's because of something that we want to see up front and design into the system and not catch later, and that is min lengths on the plug-in cards. Okay, so there's two really interesting excuse me. There's two really interesting things going on here. One thing I'm doing, I'm trying to figure out the ideal equalization, but I'm also juggling this strange phenomena of a min length on a card. If I'm only working on the equalization bundles, obviously it's laborious and not good for system configuration to sit there and tune every single channel. So the paper goes into a lot of detail about a process for starting to divide up your equalization into groups or bundles and clusters and come up with the ideal or kind of a range of equalization settings. All right? So that's one dynamic going on here. So when I did that, I created two net bundles that the paper describes, and then I applied that to my 22 scenarios, and I'm plotting eye height margin here in red. All right? And thankfully, yes, I always do have at least some margin. but I find that I can dramatically improve my eye height margin, 40% even, if I chop off and do not allow min lengths on my plug-in cards. Okay? Now, if you read the paper and understand what's happening here, now my lowest cases of margin all correspond to the maximum length channels. And that's a problem I can solve, right? I can fix that with amplitude or with equalization settings. But this problem, again, I can't fix. So that's kind of where you want to get to, right? Again, we're all pre-route. We haven't really built anything yet, but we're using simulation techniques to tell us, well, what space can I solve? What space can I not solve? And then hopefully influence the system design. So we say, if you're going to walk out of here with something, I would say remember to manage your discontinuities. At least in the world that we're looking at, that has become very relevant on the received card. The paper also shows an impulse response of two identical length channels, but I'm just tweaking, changing the length on some of the cards. Okay. Now the interesting thing, and I don't show the eye diagrams here, but the eye shape on the red channel is 20% worse than the green channel. Okay? Now that's really strange because there's absolutely no difference in their impulse response until you start to get the round trip time from the connector on the received side. Okay? So you wouldn't think, at least in this space, that I'm going to get different eye diagrams, but indeed you get a very different eye diagram. So we say pay attention to your AC cap structure, pay attention to your via stubs, and in our case, we found it very relevant to enforce that minimum length. Okay, then you get a little bit of loss into the system, you get a little bit of dissipation for the noise that's bouncing around between your receiver and your connector, because no system's perfectly terminated, right? Okay. So now I've got my equalization figured out. I've got some design constraints for my system. Now I'm going to throw this thing into the meat grinder and do thousands of simulations to see what it really looks like across manufacturing tolerances. Okay? So what we did is we got the time to an answer down to 2 minutes each for 100,000 bits, and we automated that process across 5 corners. All right? So these are the corners. What I'm talking about is fast transmit, fast receive, and so on. and found out that, yeah, sure enough, in the typical case, most of my margins are better than 50 millivolts, like I showed previously. But the sad news is, okay, because I've stressed the system, now I'm finding out some corner case situations that are close to zero margin. In fact, some are even negative margin here at the slow, slow corner. Okay, so what am I going to do about that? Well, in some ways, I'm widening the things I'm looking at. I learned earlier I can scale my transmitter up. We've been trying to keep it low for power's sake, but I might need to scale it up to handle this worst-case corner here, or I might need to create increment my equalization. So after doing that, and the paper describes that, we revised the configuration. We're still plotting typical because we want to look at that. We care about it. We've dramatically improved this FS corner if you compare the plots, and we've still got kind of a long tail on my SS corner. But this is showing that my width is staying fairly stable. If I didn't like the range, because in some ways the range from here to here is suggesting a power, maybe I'm burning too much power, I could come back in and create new equalization, additional equalization bundles, and pull in these tails even more. So that's a trade-off you have to handle in an engineering sense. To produce this plot currently today, this was a weekend. Okay, this took about a weekend of the machine just grinding and grinding and grinding. But you're looking at well over 2,000 data points there. So, to summarize, obviously modeling's a huge deal. We're cascading the model so that we can work things up front. We've learned a ton about via modeling this year and found out that that's very, very essential. We've been measuring constantly and have found some surprises and learned some great things that way. Because of the speed that we wanted to achieve, we accepted using approximate SERDES models, but we learned some great things by doing that. We've tested the sensitivity to every single variable. We've constrained some of the things that limit performance, and then we've also created equalization or tap bundles. And then exhaustively simulated across manufacturing variations. So these are simulation techniques kind of illustrated with some examples. I want to thank you for your attention and refer you to the paper as well. Thank you. You want to go ahead and do questions? Okay. If you need to leave, again, sorry to hold you up from the keynote. Wei Ling.
Can you talk about the experience you had in terms of approximate SERDES models? Did you say that your model found a supplier, or was it a generic model that found the
tool? Okay, so the question is, you're asking about variation in transmit models, and I didn't catch part of it. Okay. Oh, good question. Okay. Do I really need to go use the model from the supplier, or can I use an approximate generic model? Right. And obviously, you want to use a model from your vendor, right? If you can get that, that's going to be the best thing. You need to look at whether or not that model simulates quickly or not. I think part of in the world where we're not getting a lot of fast models out of vendors yet. Part of what the point of the paper is to breathe hope into us. I mean, how many people do simulation? Let me see a raise of hands. Okay. We need to have a little hope breathed into us that I can still do valuable work without the vendor's model if the vendor's just walking around in circles and can't figure out what to do. Okay. That's a very important observation. I can stick a TDR on my channel and learn a ton just from that. Okay. But if I take an approximate model in, I can even add to what a TDR might show me. So I want to encourage all the vendors to make progress and release models, but I want the rest of us to kind of feel liberated to just go ahead and learn about channels in light of those models not being available yet. Mike?
Just to add to your comment about approximate models, you can learn an awful lot from the data sheet. Put the data sheet information in your approximate model, and you're pretty close.
Right, right. Yeah, I've been able to play with a lot of SPICE models, and it's amazing how good you can do just by approximating things. Yeah, Arpan.
Use that line of short
Okay, the question is, why are those short traces failing? Okay, so yeah, let's come up with some good metrics like unequalizable energy and things like that. I mean, it's a really interesting, and I was getting frustrated because I knew Sergio wanted some answers, and I was playing with net lengths, and I was going a little more, and I expected to see something very linear, and I was down like at the 1/110th of an inch level, just incrementing the length on my receiver card. And if I plotted the eye height versus that would have been a fun plot to show you. I'm kind of embarrassed by it because it just goes, you know. I'm like, wow, this is really strange. So there's some dynamics there that you know, I don't have the answers for yet, but I'm happy to constrain them out of the system.
However, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead.
However, in that instance, if the connector via is perfect, and if the capacitor via is perfect, I mean really invisible, then performance improves a lot. And that very likely is telling us something very important.
Yeah. Good point. We're somewhat stuck by manufacturing requirements. Yeah, sorry, over here.
I suspect that you did some frequency analysis on those school channels, you know, finding insertion losses, return losses, you probably would have some resonance.
Yeah. Okay, the observation is if I look, spend more time in the frequency domain, I probably start to understand it and see it. And thank you. I mean, I did go play over there, and, you know, so I wish I had greater answers on that, but I think you're right. Go ahead, Ravinder. Okay, when I'm talking about short length, is it dependent on what? Oh, good question. Good question. Like define short. That's kind of what you're asking. Is that dependent on data rate? You know, that would make a great study. I wish I had a definitive answer on that. My gut tells me definitely yes.
I think it's absolutely dependent on data rate. If you did frequency domain analysis, you know, depending on the data rate, if your channel simulation shows that there's some resonance at the micro, so whatever data rate you're at,
yeah, he just said a mouthful on that tune your channel length stuff, didn't he? But we need to talk. I mean, hang out after this. Yeah, good. Okay, not just data rate, but edge rate. Okay, because that's definitely about the frequency content. Yeah, good. All right. Anything else before we close? I'm standing between you and lunch, so it's a dangerous spot. Okay? So, thanks a lot.